Thank you. Can you hear me?
Excellent.
Wow. Well, like everybody else, I would like to thank the organizers for bringing us all here to this wonderful place. And I would also like to mention my collaborators. Some of them are in the room. And especially would like to mention graduate student Hector Martinez Rodriguez, who's done a lot of the work that I will show at the end of the talk. So the Riddle of Steel is a plot device in the movie Conan the Barbarian, right? And if you're a Sumerian barbarian and you want to crush your enemies, you need reliable steel, which is made, of course, of mostly iron and carbon. But it's not so simple because you want the core of the blade to be soft steel so that it has flexibility and the edge of the blade to be a hard steel so that it can cut. Right? So you have to add these impurities to steel, and these include things like silicon, sulfur, and manganese. And that's fine if you're a barbarian, but even if you're a peace-loving astrophysicist and you have no enemies to crush, you still are interested in these things because, of course, iron and manganese and these things, they come from type 1a supernovae. And in particular, manganese, which is a neutron-rich element, and other neutron-rich elements, have very important clues on the physics of type 1a supernovae and the properties of their progenitor system. So maybe we can use these things to crush our ignorance on type 1a supernova progenitors, or at least scare it a little bit. It turns out that these neutron-rich isotopes are best observed in supernova remnants, and that's what makes it relevant for this conference. So today I will be discussing key issues in neutronization, type 1a supernova progenitors, metallicity, carbon simmering, and I will define all these terms. But I will also begin by discussing the issue of circumstellar interaction in type 1a supernova remnants, because this is something that has come up a couple of times, and I would really like to give you my view on it. So, of course, we've heard a lot about type 1a supernova progenitors, and this is well known to everyone, right? You have these different scenarios, and there are single degenerate scenarios where the white dwarf accretes slowly from a companion and then gets very close to the chain of sector limit and explodes. Double degenerate systems where you have a merger or a collision of two white dwarfs that then explode, and there's also the core degenerate scenario that Noam is very fond of. But I think sometimes we get a little too obsessed with these names, and I really like this idea that Wolfgang put forward of just talking about accretors and mergers. And I have a quote here by Shakespeare so that you don't think that I spend all my time watching movies with Arnold Schwarzenegger in them. So I don't think the names are that interesting, but of course the physics is really important. So if you just do the most naive and simple of assumptions, you would expect white dwarfs that accrete slowly till the chain of sector limit or close to it and then explode to have that mass when they explode and to have some circumstellar material, because this accretion process can't possibly be 100% efficient. And then systems that merge or collide should not necessarily explode close to the chain of sector limit. And they can have circumstellar material if the explosion happens shortly after something like a common envelope episode, but they don't have to. If the merger just comes from a gravitational wave emission, the environment of these progenitors could be relatively clean. And these are the kind of distinctions that we want to make when we look at the progenitors. Now, depending on the mass loss history of the progenitor, you're going to have circumstellar material that will look one way or another according to, basically the theory of winds and interstellar wind bubbles. Sometimes you're going to have cavities if the outflows are fast. Sometimes you're going to have density proportional to r^-2 profiles. But one point I would like to make is if you just think in a cartoon picture where you plot density here and radius here, the traditional way of constraining this is to look at supernovae weeks or months after the explosion. And when you do that, you're constraining things in this regime. Okay? But when you look at supernova remnants, you constrain things in this regime. And this is what makes the supernova remnant aspect of this study so important. Right? If you, again, think of simple outflows from supernovae, when you look at supernovae, you're talking about things that were expelled by the progenitor tens to hundreds of years before the explosion and have the size of the outer solar system. You look at remnants, you're talking about thousands to millions of years before the explosion, and sizes of parsecs. And this is the key difference, because these are the spatial and temporal scales that are relevant for cell revolution of the supernova progenitors. These are timescales that are the order of the Kelvin-Helmholtz timescale for an evolved star. And this makes it very relevant to the issue of the progenitors. The price you pay when you look at supernova remnants is that, of course, you can only probe dynamical interaction. There needs to be enough circumstellar material to decelerate the ejecta by a measurable amount. In other words, you have some delicate wisps of wind structure dumping 10 to the 51 hertz of kinetic energy in them is not going to be a very delicate way to probe them. Okay? So the way we constrain this kind of interaction with supernova remnants, of course, is by looking at the ionization timescale of the X-ray spectra. And this is something that's relatively simple. The denser the material, the faster ionization will proceed, because it's a collisional process. And when you look at actual spectra, what happens is that more or stronger circumstellar interaction tends to make the luminosities higher and pushes the centroids to higher energy, because you're looking at more advanced ionization states for the same element. This is something that we've been doing for some time, and I did it back in 2007 with Jack Hughes by looking at silicon, but of course it's much more interesting to look at iron, because iron has 26 electrons and gives you access to a very wide range of ionization timescales. This is an excellent idea. I can say it's an excellent idea because it's not mine. This is something that Hiroe Yamaguchi started some time back, and I told him it probably wouldn't work, and I've never been so glad to be wrong. A number of people have already showed this plot. I just want to make a few salient points here. These are remnants from mostly Suzaku data, one Chandra and one XMM object from those references there. What I'm showing here is the luminosity in the iron K-alpha line and the centroid energy. Okay, and the striking feature of this plot is that all the type 1a remnants end up here, and all the core collapse remnants end up here. So these are low ionization timescales, these are high ionization timescales, and because these objects in the 1a and core collapse sample have similar ages and sizes, the difference has to be from circumstellar interaction. This is what several solar masses of circumstellar material from a massive star progenitor look like, and this is what very little circumstellar interaction looks like. Another thing is that these shaded regions that you see here, these are standard type 1a ejecta models, Chan-Sekhar mass, delayed detonation models, that are interacting with the uniform ambient medium. And as you can see, they can reproduce the data points very well. I think beyond distinguishing 1A from core collapse remnants, which is nice, the key aspect of this is that we can evaluate stellar evolution and explosion in the same object, because this is directly connected to the mass loss from the progenitors. So the models are shown here. I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I do want to point out also that it's important to show beyond the centroids, which is what appeared in that plot, the physical sizes of the remnants, because this is where you see whether an actual, a specific scenario for the circumstellar interaction works or not. You can see here, these are the same data points, all the 1A remnants, the core collapse remnants are up there, they're probably swimming in the pool that's above us, and this is just physical size and parsecs. And again, these are the uniform ambient medium models. And what you can see is that uniform media interaction really explains all the type 1a objects very well. Not only does it give the correct ionization state for iron, but it gives the correct sizes for the actual objects. Okay. What this means is that most type 1a supernova remnants are compatible with just an interaction with the uniform ambient medium. Does that mean that there is no circumstellar interaction? Of course not. But there are certain things that you can rule out. This is interaction with a uniform wind, typical for a red giant companion to the progenitor. And you can see that it's not going to work for any of these objects, right? At very small sizes, the remnant shoots up and ends up here. Now, we know some of these objects probably do have some kind of circumstellar interaction. There's Kepler there and 103b there. And there are several models that you can make work for this, but a uniform amium medium really seems to work very well for most of the sample. The one exception is RCW86, which is clearly a different kind of object. It's a cavity explosion. And if RCW86 came from a normal type 1a supernova, the only way I can see to explain this is really a sustained outflow, fast sustained outflow from a supernova progenitor. And I think that's a very important point that has been made by several people already. Okay, so what we have is a situation where the supernova observations and the supernova remnant observations seem to be telling a coherent picture that as a first order approximation, uniform amium medium interaction explains things very well. This would point directly towards, let's say, a clean merger scenario. A number of people have proposed alternative scenarios for some of these remnants, and we've seen a couple of talks in the conference. I just want to encourage people to calculate those centroids, because if you have a specific scenario that you want to make work for your favorite remnant, this should be your first stop. You should make sure that you can reproduce the bulk dynamics and ionization of the object. Of course, as I was saying, this doesn't mean there's no circumstellar interaction. There could be some. But we have to be careful with what kind of models we allow here. Okay, and well, there was a Franciscan monk called William of Ockham that had very good advice if one's going to shake. You know, if a simple hypothesis explains things, then you have to think twice before you propose a complicated model. There are, of course, improvements that we can do to these. I don't want to talk too much about it because Dan Padnov is going to discuss some of these tomorrow. And I wanna get to the neutrons that were in the title of my talk. So when you have a carbon-oxygen white dwarf and you ignite a thermonuclear runaway in the central regions, you consume the material in different burning regimes. You have explosive oxygen burning, silicon burning, then nuclear statistic equilibrium, neutron-rich nuclear statistic equilibrium. This is what gives the elements that we see in the ejecta. Now, I said the manganese and neutron-rich isotopes are important, and one very good question you can make is, well, how do you make neutron-rich isotopes in a carbon-oxygen white dwarf, right? Because carbon and oxygen do not have any neutron excess. They have the same number of neutrons and protons. And in order to make neutron-rich isotopes, you need neutrons. So where do these neutrons come from, right? Well, there are three ways to make neutrons in type 1a supernovae. You can either make neutrons during stellar evolution, you can make them just before the explosion, or you can make them during the explosion. Now, from stellar evolution, the neutrons come from the progenitor metallicity, and this is because type 1a supernovae come from intermediate mass stars that burn hydrogen through the CNO cycle. The bottleneck of the CNO cycle is the nitrogen 14 alpha gamma reaction, and that means that when you're done burning hydrogen, all the carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen pile onto nitrogen 14. During hydrostatic helium burning, this nitrogen-14 captures two alpha particles and has a beta decay and becomes neon-22. So you end up in a situation where your carbon-oxygen white dwarfs are made mostly of carbon and oxygen, which have no neutron excess, and there's a trace amount of neon-22 which carries a neutron excess, and the amount of neon-22 is proportional to the metallicity of the progenitor of the white dwarf. Okay, and this is something that was pointed out by Frank Timmis back in 2003. Another way to make neutrons is just before the explosion. Turns out that if you picture a white dwarf that's accreting hydrogen, it will become denser and hotter. And it becomes when the core of the white dwarf becomes dense and hot enough, you will ignite the carbon. But this doesn't trigger a thermonuclear runaway. The white dwarf does not explode when you ignite the carbon at the center. This is because neutrinos carry that heat outside the white dwarf. What happens is that you develop a large convective core. In this convective core, you can have weak interactions on the products of carbon fusion, and those can also increase the neutron excess. But this requires slow accretion And a white dwarf that's very close to the Chan-Seker limit, because in order to ignite carbon, you have to be very close to the Chan-Seker limit. You need a very dense white dwarf, and they are degenerate objects. So the more massive they are, the denser they get. And the third way to make neutrons is during the explosion itself. And this is a combustion regime that we call neutron-rich nuclear statistic equilibrium. What happens here is that in the central regions of the white dwarf, the density is so high that you can have electron captures onto the nuclei, and this shifts the equilibrium point from NSC away from nickel 56 and towards more neutron-rich species. So immediately in this slide tells you, again, you require the Chan-Seker mass for this, because the densities at which neutron-rich NSC happens are densities that you only find in the cores of white dwarfs that are very close to a Chan-Seker limit. And now you know why we care about neutrons. There are three ways to make neutrons in type 1a supernovae. And each of these three ways is related to a specific property of the progenitor: metallicity, whether it had a slow accretion phase before the explosion or not, and the mass. These two mechanisms require white dwarfs that are close to the Chan-Seker limit. This does not. This here will affect mostly the iron peak yields. This, in principle, could affect everything. Okay, so what does this look like when you calculate a supernova explosion model? The standard way to explode supernovae that are around the Chan-Seker mass is this paradigm we call delayed detonation. And these are models that have been very successful. I've explained light curves and spectra of type 1a supernovae. And I just wanted to show you what it looks like for this neutron-rich NSC regime here. This is the dense core of the white dwarf where you have the nickel and the manganese and the neutron-rich species being produced. Okay? And of course, you can try to reproduce bright type 1a or dim type 1a by varying the transition of the deflagration to the detonation density, but you always will have this core of neutron-rich material. If you have a sub-Chan-Seker explosion, on the other hand, you never have this core of neutron-rich material because the densities are not high enough. So armed with this knowledge, you can make this tentative simple connection, right? Chan-Seker mass explosions that look like the delayed detonation models should, in principle, come from single degenerate progenitors or accretors, because that explains the Chan-Seker mass more naturally, and they produce high amounts of manganese and nickel. So Chan-Seker explosions you could have or form through mergers or double degenerates, and you expect less manganese and less nickel. Now, if you put this in a plot, this is manganese to iron, this is nickel to iron, this is what the Chan-Seker models look like. All right? The more metal-rich the progenitor, the more manganese and nickel you produce because of the effect with the neon-22. And you can compare with the subchandra models, and you have the same effect. Right? The more metal-rich the progenitor, the more manganese and nickel you produce, but there is a limit to how high you can go with the subchandra models. This is for a metallicity that is 5 times solar. Right? So if you observe an object and the manganese to iron and nickel to iron ratios are in this regime, you can be pretty sure it came from a Chan-Seker mass white dwarf and probably from an accretor progenitor. And, well, Brian already showed this the first day of the conference, but this is the kind of measurement that we were able to make for this remnant 3C397, which is an object that really has an extraordinary spectrum. And if you look at this X-ray spectrum, that's chromium, manganese, iron, and nickel, that is way supersolar iron to nickel ratio there. It has a lot of nickel. A lot of nickel. And if you put the measurement in comparison with the models, again, you see that you have this inescapable conclusion. Right? If you want to reproduce this object with a non-crazy metallicity for the progenitor, you have to have a Chan-Seker mass white dwarf. And this is an important result. This is the cleanest measurement of the mass of a type 1a supernova progenitor, the mass of the exploding white dwarf that you can make. And it's not a model-dependent statement. This comes from density. Right? It comes from the physics of degenerate objects. You need white dwarfs close to the Chan-Seker limit to have the densities that you require for these electron capture reactions in the core. You can look at the details. It's already published. You can look at the details in Yamaguchi et al. And in the last part of the talk, this is just a different way to look at the same data. The blue here is the neutron-rich NSC material. And the red here is what you eject in the rest of the white dwarf things. And you can see that what we're seeing in 3C397 is really the signature of this neutron-rich NSC regime, which requires a transsecular mass progenitor. Okay, so we've done these measurements now for a number of objects, and this talk, like many talks in this conference, was going to be a very exciting outlook for what Hitomi could do, because, of course, if you want to measure the lines from manganese and chromium and nickel, a high-resolution calorimeter is the way to go. These are very weak lines. They're not very strong above the continuum, so you need the spectral resolution to tell them apart. So it turns out we're not going to be able to do this for most objects. Tycho, Kepler, and 3C397 is pretty much as far as it goes. And these three measurements that we've done, every time that we've done them, have given us very high metallicities for the progenitor. In the case of 3C397, on top of that, it requires a transsecular mass progenitor, but for Tycho and Kepler, we got very high metallicities. And we thought this was going to be it, but recently we realized that the calcium yield in type 1a supernova models also depends on metallicity, depends on the metallicity of the progenitor. And this is something that is independent of what happens in the neutron-rich nuclear statistic equilibrium regime. And the calcium line, of course, is a lot easier to measure than manganese and chromium and nickel. Right? I almost wanted to change the title of my talk, but I thought the riddle of chalk didn't sound very very enticing. Right? So this allows us to measure neutron excess or metallicity in more supernova remnants, including those in the LMC. And this is the work by my graduate student that I want to talk about in the last few minutes that I have. So what you have here, this is chromium to iron, this is calcium to sulfur. Maybe calcium to silicon would be a more natural line ratio, but as you know, the Suseku detectors have a cheap gap on top of the silicon, so calcium to sulfur is the best way to go. And these are the measurements for 3C397, Kepler, and Tycho using calcium. And we recover these high metallicities that we saw with manganese and chromium. In particular, for 3C397, it's very, very high. It's a metallicity of 5 times solar, which I will come back to in a minute. But the interesting thing is that now we can do this for a supernova remnants in the LMC. And this is the measurement for N103b, which is the LMC remnant with the best X-ray spectrum. And you can already tell that there's something strange going on, okay? Because these, are very high metallicities. This is 5 times solar. This is 2 times solar. This is just slightly subsolar. It's almost solar. So it's very hard to explain this object and that object, 3C397 and N103b, just with metallicity from the progenitor. Now, neutron-rich nuclear statistical equilibrium has nothing to do with this because this is calcium. So this happens outside in the white dwarf, far away from the dense core. So what's going on? How special are these metallicities? Well, if you're an American, you probably heard about Lake Rubicon, a fictional town in Minnesota where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average, right? No matter how much you love your child, you know, all children can't possibly be above average. So if you want to compare the metallicities that you infer from the remnants with the metallicities of the stars that would give birth to them, you have to plot something like this. This is a very nice plot that Actor made. What I'm showing here is the metallicity distribution function from apogee stars as a function of galactocentric radius. And earlier in the conference, for instance, Bill made a point that, yeah, we've discussed, for instance, that Kepler is neutron nitrogen-rich. It turns out Kepler isn't a part of Milky Way that has high metallicity, so maybe that's not that extraordinary. So this is how you compare the metallicities that you infer from the remnants to the metallicities of the star, And you see immediately before 3C397 and N103b, these neutrons cannot possibly come from metallicity. Okay, these metallicities are crazy. Well, if there are three ways to make neutrons, and it's non-metallicity, and it's non-neutron-rich NSC, which is only going to affect iron peak yields, there's only one thing left, and that's simmering. But simmering requires slow accretion and grow up of mass to the transsecular limit and an explosion then. Okay, so it seems that not only 3C397, but also N103b probably had transsecular mass progenitors because it's the only way to make this work. Okay? And I just want to put out the summary there. I want to I still have 5 minutes. Good. So I'll recap a little bit. So what have we learned? We have learned from the centroids of the RNK-alpha line that type 1a supernova remnants have way less circumstellar interaction than core collapse supernova remnants. This is not unexpected, and it's a good thing that it should be so, but what these measurements give us is the opportunity to test specific stellar evolution scenarios. And I really encourage anyone who's presenting a stellar evolutionist scenario for a supernova remnant to do simple calculations along these lines. Okay, if you want to calculate ionization timescales that include cosmic ray acceleration, all sorts of bells and whistles, that's more complicated. But to make a first approach, zero-order, simple 1D model is very easy, and it's a very powerful discriminant tool for your favorite circumstellar interaction scenario. Most type 1a supernova remnants seem to be of a class that shows very little circumstellar interaction. RCW86 is the exception. If RCW86 came from a normal type 1a supernova, it had a progenitor that excavated a large cavity around it, and in that sense, it's unique. So maybe it didn't come from a normal type 1a supernova. We don't know. It would be really good to know. Supernova remnant 3C397, has too much manganese and nickel to be explained with anything except a Chan-Sekhar mass or near Chan-Sekhar mass progenitor. And this is a very important measurement. But we have seen high neutron excesses not only in 3C397, but also in N103b. And it's clear now that these neutron excesses cannot be attributed to metallicity. There has to be something different going on. And because these are now measured using the calcium line, the neutron-rich nuclear statistic equilibrium regime cannot be responsible for those. And as Sherlock Holmes said, once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how unlikely, must be true. So at least in these two objects, there was probably a slow accretion process that led to the destabilization of the white dwarf. I don't want to say single degenerate, but that's what everyone's thinking, I guess. This is interesting because other measurements that some people have discussed actually lend support to the merger scenario over the accretor scenario. We've seen how these are missing the companions, that the late time distribution of type 1a supernovae has a lot of power at late times, and that's hard to explain with single degenerate systems. We've measured now the rate at which white dwarfs merge in the disk of the Milky Way, and that happens to be exactly the rate at which type 1a supernovae explode in SBC type spirals. You know, this could be a coincidence, and of course these all are indirect measurements, but seems that a picture is starting to emerge. Unfortunately, it's a complex picture, but a picture is starting to emerge wherein type 1a supernovae and star-forming galaxies probably come from a mixture of progenitors, accretors, and mergers. And I think supernova remnants have a lot to say and a lot to bring to the table in this particular problem. And that's all I have for now. I'll take your questions if you have them.
In your plot, one of your slightly earlier plots, just a few slides forward. This one, yes, actually, this one slide forward. No, the next one, sorry.
Oh, that one?
No, one more.
One more?
No, I mean the one just before your conclusions.
The one just before my conclusions, the one with the metallicity distribution function? Yeah.
Right. So I know the numbers are small, but it looks as if even Kepler and Tycho are on the high metallicity side.
Yes. So I went a little fast. This, is, of course, is the median of the metallicity distribution function, and these are one sigma and two sigma layers. And this is from the Apogee survey, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, Apogee survey. But yeah, Kepler and above all Tycho seem to be rather high. Especially Tycho, considering where it is, the metallicity is actually lower for Tycho, but it is in a very metal-poor part of the galaxy. It's going out. So this is, yeah. So when I say that 3C397 and N103b require some extraneous source of neutrons, that may actually apply to Tycho and Kepler too.
Okay, good. That's what I wondered if you would go there.
It certainly cannot rule it out, but
further questions? over here.
A very nice talk. From my small experience, I started to be a bit skeptical about a non-holistic approach of the properties of a supernova remnant. There are two examples, Tycho and Kepler. For example, Kepler, when we wrote the model of the AGB bow-shaped wing, the dynamics and the morphology are reproduced very nicely, but then at your work, you say, yeah, but considering the X-ray spectra, we need extra ingredients.
Yeah.
So the one reproduces the one thing and the other. Or the vice versa, Tycho, you can one interstellar medium model can reproduce the spectra but cannot reproduce the dynamics. So without the holistic approach of specific supernova remnants, can we really draw firm conclusions?
You're totally right about that. That's the point, that's exactly the point that I was trying to make. You can always do hydrodynamic modeling and try to explain this or that aspect, but this is all tied together. The X-ray spectra come from the hydrodynamics, and unless you have a believable model for one, you can't really, for one and the other, you can't really say much about what's going on in a particular object. I mean, in the case of Kepler, there's work that you have done, and also we looked at this with Dan Patnod. A standard Earth to the minus 2 wind that goes all the way to the progenitor doesn't work. But if you put a small cavity around the remnant, dynamics work. This is a lot more contrived, of course, but it doesn't mean that that's not what's going on. And I think Pat Slane found that a small cavity works for us. If so, it's unfortunate, right? Because we're looking at the remnants after they have overrun these wonderful cavities that are the telltale sign of what the progenitor did. But it's possible.
Okay, let's go to Bill.
This is really cool stuff.
Thank you.
So you had three possible mechanisms for producing the extra neutrons.
Yep.
How confident are you that there isn't some other mechanism that people haven't thought of yet?
That's an excellent question. Now, this mechanism's... I'm usually very wary of things like model-independent. I think every time some astrophysicist said this is a model-independent statement, that they're actually lying in one level or another. This is very robust. Okay, this is just a density argument. And as far as we understand the nuclear physics, this should hold. This is also very robust, because this has to do with, hydrostatic burning during stellar evolution, and these are models that have been exhaustively verified by comparison to stellar populations and all that. This is more iffy. We're trying to infer what's going on in a white dwarf that's about to explode. Typically, the models that have been done for this have been, analytic or semi-analytic. Earlier this year, we published a study using MESA, And we saw an increase in the neutron axis. It doesn't seem to be high enough to explain the neutron axis that we see. But again, this of these three things, this is by far the most uncertain. The good news is that it still requires the Chan-Seggermans. And it can only increase the neutron axis, not decrease it. So it doesn't make some of the statements that I make dubious, but definitely more work is needed there.
Okay, let's go to Wolfgang.
Two questions. The first one, DEMEL 316 A and B. That's the one where there's one oxygen, one iron rich. I now know the acronyms a little bit at least.
Yeah.
You should do the ionization. Have you done this ionization timescale test there?
No.
Because that would be very interesting.
This is the 1A and the core collapse that are next to each other?
Yeah. So I guess, I don't know, what would you find there? Well, I guess they might not be next to each other. They might be in projection, but I think that would be.
Well, the good thing about this, the dependence on neutron axis on calcium, is that calcium is a lot easier to measure, right? If you have to do manganese and chromium, just pretty much forget about it. But if there is a calcium line and a sulfur line, then you can make a measurement.
The second question, or the second comment is on this. I don't like your conclusions, but I think this is This is pretty solid evidence.
I don't like my conclusions either.
So there's a couple of other comments to this. So Zaitan Saladal has done the manganese measurement, and I think, well, they found that you need at least some
Chandrasekhar. Yes.
The question is, I don't remember, do you need all of them to be Chandrasekhar mass? Can all of them be Chandrasekhar mass?
No. I don't think all of them are Chandrasekhar mass, but I can probably tell you later why.
The second comment is to Occam's razor. I mean, no, why not say they are all accretors and see if you can get along with this? I mean, it's then strange why you would not see the companion. But
if they're all accretors, as I said, and again, once you get into modeling mass transfer and these binary systems, things are very uncertain. But the simple argument is that if you are growing slowly in mass, it's very hard to envision how that could be 100% efficient. So there should be something. Now, the question is whether that something can agree with the observations or not. Uniform ambient medium, which is nothing, works fine. But that doesn't mean there's no circumstellar interaction. You could probably come up with models that have maybe a small cavity here, or maybe the mass loss is episodic and you know, wipes out a large region. But again, you can't go too low. You can't have the low density cavities, because then you get RCW86, not Tycho, no Kepler, no SN1006. So you have to work within that parameter space.
Well, very nice work.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, last question, right behind.
These arguments are very convincing, and my conclusion is that neither the single degenerate nor the double degenerate can work. You need to look on all observation, and some observations are very good, explained very good by the single degenerate, some by the double degenerate. But then you look at the other and they rule them out. So if you come with an explanation for each supernova, then I accept it. But if I want to look for something that can also live with it, that they are almost the same, I need to look for one explanation. And I think the core degenerate, which has many open questions, and maybe eventually will not work, at present does the best. About the iron K line, I think you need to consider collision within the supernova ejecta. The core collapse are highly asymmetric, and we saw some images with velocity to different directions. So it might be internal collision. And with this Chandrasekhar mass, the core degenerate requires Chandrasekhar mass. And the single degenerate is great, but we don't find the companion. So, you know, we are astronomers, we look for stars.
So one thing that I would, because I get your points about the core degenerate, and I think this idea that you have of supernovae, type 1a supernovae exploding inside planetary nebulae is very interesting. But again, does it reproduce the ionization states that we see? Because if there's a lot of material or a low-density cavity, then it's going to be hard to make things work. So I know you've done some hydrodynamic modeling, but really just a simple calculation of the ionization state of iron, and it doesn't have to be sophisticated, just to see whether you get the bulk properties of the remnants in the right ballpark or not. That would be fantastic, I think.
Okay, let's thank Carlos again.
Thank you.